What was that?
There's just a note that the conversation is being recorded now.
Oh, okay, okay. We're going to go on with Hamsaguya prayers. By the way, I looked up Hamsaguya. It is actually in the Mona Williams Sanskrit dictionary. It means Guya means the mystery of the Hamsa means the supreme soul and the individual soul. Just to let you know. Since Prabhupada never translates the Hamsaguya. So this is what we're going to do. We look at the traditional Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We'll do that three times responsively like we do at the beginning of the class. And then everybody should hit the mute button on the phone because everybody is unmuted. There will be a lot of background noise. So we will begin like this. Huh? Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Okay, now you got to hit those mute buttons, Sam. That went pretty well. Okay, this is Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6. It's Chapter 4, the Hamsa Guhya prayers. And now we are going on. These are spoken by Prajapati Daksha in his second incarnation, born of the Prachetas and a daughter of an Apsara. So text number 24, I'll just read the Sanskrit. Today we're going to do 24 and 25 together. So 24 goes like this. Nayasya sakyam purusho vaiti sakyuhu sakavasansam vatsamvasata puresmin guno yata gunino vakya tristis asmai maheshaya namaskaromi. Translation. As the sense objects, form, taste, touch, smell, and sound, cannot understand how the senses perceive them, so the conditioned soul, although residing in his body, along with the super soul, cannot understand how the supreme spiritual person, the master of the material creation, directs his senses. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto that supreme person who is the supreme controller. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The individual soul and the supreme soul live together within the body. This is confirmed in the Upanishads by the analogy that two friendly birds live in one tree. One bird eating the fruit of the tree and the other simply witnessing and directing. Although the individual living being, who's compared to the bird that is eating, is sitting with his friend, the supreme soul, the individual living being cannot see him. Actually, the super soul is directing the workings of his senses in the enjoyment of sense objects. But as these sense objects cannot see the senses, the conditioned soul cannot see the directing soul. The conditioned soul has desires, and the supreme soul fulfills them. But the conditioned soul is unable to see the supreme soul. Thus, Prajapati Daksha offers his obeisances unto the supreme soul, the super soul, even though unable to see him. Another example given is that although ordinary citizens work under the direction of the government, they cannot understand how they are being governed or what that government is, especially if it's the Bush administration. In this regard, Madhvacharya quotes the following verse from the Skanda Purana, Yata Rajna Priyatantu Mritya Vedena Chatmanaha Yata Jivo Nayat Sakyam Veti Tasmai Namostute. As the various servants in the different departments of big establishments cannot see the supreme managing director under whom they are working, the conditioned soul cannot see the supreme friend sitting within their bodies. Let us therefore offer our respectful obeisances unto the supreme who is invisible to our material eyes. Okay, so here, is continuing with a point that Prajapati Daksha made in the very beginning of his prayers. Prabhupada mentions that actually he recited these prayers but did not compose them himself. They were already extant, and so he just recited them, which is good to know, because one should offer prayers to the Lord, and if one cannot, we cannot compose suitable prayers ourselves, we can always recite exemplary prayers by others, which is always a good way to start. And then you can branch off. We can branch off into our own. But anyway, so Daksha is using these previously existing prayers, and in those prayers, it's mentioned there. About the Supreme Lord. The conditioned souls who have accepted this material manifestation as everything cannot see him, for he is above the evidence of experimental knowledge. Self-evident and self-sufficient, he is not caused by any superior cause. And we notice this the last time, as Prabhupada brings out in his translation, that he is simultaneously not seen in the text Adrista Damne. He's in his abode and is Adrista, not seen by the conditioned soul, Gunatatta Buddhidi, whose intelligence is directed toward the material nature. Not seen by them, yet, as Prabhupada says, at the same time, self-evident. So we talked about that a bit, how whenever somebody says something is self-evident, you can say, well, self-evident to whom? Not self-evident to everybody. But maybe to those who have certain qualifications to see, then when it is seen, is self-evident. Maybe we can talk about that some more. So anyway, he talks in the first verse about his transcendence, and something that's transcended means it's beyond. So beyond our knowledge, beyond our minds, beyond our sense perception, they cannot go there. So he now, in his prayers, expands upon this with this, with this example, and you notice here in this example, the Lord is described here as the sambhatsataha. It means your somebody you're cohabiting with, your roommate. somebody who lives in the same place with you. In the body, and if you look at the Sanskrit in this verse, the word for friendship shows up three different ways: sakyam, one form or another, sakyam, the condition of relationship of friendship, fraternity. The Lord is sakyahu, the Saka, the living entity. I think that refers to the living entity. Who's the friend? So three times, sakyam, sakyu, saka, the condition of friendship and close. closeness of living close together as roommates or co-inhabitants has been stressed here. And yet, you don't see him. Even so, not seen. And there's a sort of a hierarchy of visibility and not being visible. So the sense objects, here when they say sense objects, it means, strictly speaking, what's called in Sanskrit the ton mantras. Form means the objects of the sense of sight, like form and color. Taste or flavors, the objects of the sense of touch. Then there's hardness, softness, smoothness, roughness, heat, cold, objects of the sense of touch. Odors, the objects of the sense of smell, and the sounds, the objects of the sense of hearing. So these sense objects, they are not aware of how the senses perceive them. And in the same way, the conditioned soul, who's actually the perceiver through the senses, doesn't perceive the super soul, who's witnessing him. So the super soul sees the soul, who doesn't see the super soul, and the soul sees the sense objects, which don't see the soul or even the senses. They don't understand they are being perceived. So that's the example. Just as the sense objects don't understand how the senses are perceiving them, so we don't perceive. We're in a certain way unconscious and not perceiving how the super soul is seeing us, who is our cohabitant in this body. Prabhupada cites this well-known verse. I think it's from the Upanishads, the Mundaka Upanishad, which says there are two birds, Dva Suparna, Sayuja, together, Sakaya, as friends in a tree. And they're sitting together. And one is enjoying and tasting the fruits of the tree, the eating bird, and the other is simply looking on, is the witness of the enjoying bird. So the fruits are the sense objects, which are the fruit is described as sweet and sour. So just the sense objects bring pain and pleasure. The fruits are sweet and bitter or sour. So the eating bird is preoccupied with this and is not even conscious of, as he goes from branch to branch, accompanied by the friendly bird, it goes from branch to branch, which means changing bodies, and is not aware of the presence of the witnessing bird. So this is the all the descriptions are there of the super soul, who is described in the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, 23rd text, Upadrasta Anumanta Cha. The 13th chapter describes how there's two knowers in the body, the field. And so there's the living entity, and then Upadrasta, another knower, who is Upadrasta. Upadrasta means the overseer, Anumanta, the permitter, Bharta, the master, Bhokta, the supreme enjoyer, Maheshwara, the supreme lord. And then it uses this word, Parama Atma, the super soul. This is a list of names, because itti, Upadrasta, Anumanta, Bharta, Bhokta, Maheshwara, Parama Atma. And this is the Purushaha Paraha, the supreme Purusha. So the Lord is actually present, close by, and doing something. Making things happen. And we are not conscious of this because, as far as I can understand, what the Bhagavad Gita and the Bhagavatam actually say is the living entity is on a yantra, a machine, which is the body, the gross and subtle body, which works as a machine, and it is actually not the living entity that directly runs the machine. The machine of the body is being run by the upadrasta and the anumanta, the overseer and the permitter, who runs it for the sake of the living entity. So it works for us. We don't know how it's working. But it does. Whenever we want to move my hand, the hand moves. I've got no idea how it works, but it works. And the Lord is sitting there, actually is the one who controls material nature. So he's actually, as far as I understand, the living entity, in a very literal sense, doesn't do anything. That's why also when the analogy is there of a chariot, the chariot is the body. And the chariot driver is not the living entity. The chariot driver is the Lord. And the living entity is the passenger. And then the senses of the horses and the reins of the intelligence. So we are not the ones who are causing this body to work. He's running it for us, making our senses work, and is controlling the living entities and controlling the illusory energy. And because we're conditioned soul means we are not aware of this. We're so absorbed in trying to enjoy the material world, and actually with the purpose of forgetting our relationship with Krishna, that we are not able to see him, because we are blinded by Krishna. He gives us the intelligence by which we can forget him. Prabhupada says it is by Krishna's mercy we remember Krishna, and by Krishna's mercy we forget him. That's what's happened. I want to read you a poem by Ralph Waldo Emerson called Brahma. Emerson had read the Bhagavad Gita, and Brahma, by Brahma he means Brahman, he means Krishna. And so he picked up this point about the super soul. It begins like this, with almost a literal quotation from the Bhagavad Gita. If the red slayer thinks he slays, or the slain thinks he is slain, they know not the subtle ways I keep and pass and turn again. So that's practically a quotation, the first two lines. Huh? Then it goes like this: far and forgot to me are near, shadow and sunlight are the same, the vanished gods to me appear, and one to me are shame and fame. They reckon ill who leave me out. Here's the point I want to get to. They reckon ill who leave me out. When they me fly, I am the wings. I fly, here's a 19th century usage, meaning fly away, flee from me. When they me fly, I am the wings. I am the doubter and the doubt, and I the song the Brahmin sings. And so then he concludes, the strong gods pine for my abode, and pine in vain the sacred seven, the Saptarshis. But thou, meek lover of the good, find me and turn thy back on heaven. That's not bad, huh? for somebody who... So he has this line, when they me fly, I am the wings. So he managed to pick this up from whatever translation he had in the days of yore. And... Emerson was a 19th century American thinker of and poet and writer, one of what they call the New England Transcendentalists. And so, so when we forget Krishna, it is by Krishna's mercy that we forget. He is the enabler for both coming to him and turning away from him. He gives him the intelligence, just as when we want to come with Krishna, he makes the arrangement. Prabhupada says here, the conditioned soul has desires, and the Supreme Soul fulfills them. But the conditioned soul is unable to see the Supreme Soul. So the Supreme Soul is at work every minute. We can't, Prabhupada remarks somewhere, we cannot see anything without Krishna seeing it first. We cannot taste anything without Krishna's tasting it first. Actually, and very intimately connected with us, but at the same time unseen by his will. But his will is really consequent upon our desires. And this is a point that Prabhupada is always emphasizing. And so what we become concerned with is how it is that which is unseeable and unknowable and yet so close to us actually becomes knowable. The next verse goes on, so we'll do this one. It has a very short purport and continues the same theme. This is text number 25. Deho savoksha manavo bhuta matram atmanam anyam chavadu puram yat sarvam pumandera gunam stetajna naveda sarvam sarvajnam anam anantam ide. Because they are only matter, the body, the life air, the external and internal senses, the five gross elements, and the subtle sense objects, form, taste, smell, sound, and touch, cannot know their own nature, the nature of other senses, or the nature of their controller. But the living being, because of his spiritual nature, can know his body, the life airs, the senses, the elements and the sense objects. And he can also know the three qualities that form their roots. Nevertheless, although the living being is completely aware of it, he is unable to see the Supreme Being, who is omniscient, unlimited. Therefore, I offer my respectful obeisances unto him. So see, this continues with the same idea that the living entity actually is conscious and therefore is conscious of all the elements of creation. Although these elements cannot know their own natures, living entity can, and can distinguish and understand one nature, one of their natures from the nature of one from the nature of the other, and can also understand the foundation, how they evolve out of the three modes and so on. All these things a living entity can understand, yet is unable to see the Supreme Lord. Prabhupada says in the purport, material scientists can make an analytical study of the physical elements, the body, the senses, the sense objects, and even the air that controls the vital force, the prana. But still they cannot understand that above all these is the real spirit soul. In other words, the living entity, because of his being a spirit soul, can understand all the material objects, or when self-realized, he can understand the Paramatma upon whom yogis meditate. Nevertheless, the living being, even if advanced, cannot understand the Supreme Being, the personality of Godhead, for he is ananta, limited in all six opulences. So the material elements are clear and available to us and can be understood and analyzed in various ways. That's because we're spirit soul. But the Paramatma, upon whom the yogis meditate, is not known. And in spite of all the intelligence that goes to understanding material nature, the Paramatma is not visible. And he goes on to say, here he seems to be referring to Bhagavan, who's even beyond Paramatma. Even if you're a yogi and you understand Paramatma, even still further, because Paramatma is still a limited idea. In the Bhagavatam, Prabhupada gives the argument that Paramatma cannot be the full Godhead, because God is something more than an order supplier for the living entities. And so beyond Paramatma, there is Bhagavan. It's the same Lord, but Paramatma is called an amsha, or a part of the Lord, because Paramatma is only involved in the material energy, running the material energy, and dealing with the conditioned souls, the souls who are in the material energy. Whereas Bhagavan, then that is the Lord in association with his spiritual energy. Same Supreme Lord, there's only one God, but still has the different manifest aspects. So this continues the theme, and then the next verse, now he'll start talking about the possibility of transcending, of going beyond coming to a position where we can actually become aware of the Paramatma, or of the omniscient Lord. And that will be very useful to do that. It'll be useful. It'll also be useful materially, because we can then actually even understand how the world is really working. If we leave out this vast, act, living, intelligent system that's running the universe, we're going to miss out with something really important to know about. There's this acronym, VALIS, that I've stole from a title of a science fiction novel by Philip K. Dick. vast, active, living, intelligent system. And that describes one aspect of the of God. The Supersoul feature is exactly like that vast, active, living intelligence and system. So that you can, according to Wikipedia, there's actually a some kind of game based on Valis. Anyway, he had a novel with that title, I think. You know Philip K. Dick, the legendary Philip K. Dick? You know that movie, Blade Runner? It has Hare Krishna devotees chanting in it. And that book is based on a story by Philip K. Dick. Anyway, so much for mundane knowledge. Now, how to get to know that? If one actually... Our brains are very limited. They're conditioned. We don't know very much. One of our problems in this world is lack of knowledge. And we keep trying to figure it out. And it's very, very hard. Even if you take some small subject matter and you try to understand it thoroughly, it turns out there's more than you can handle. But historians or philosophers who want to try to really understand history in a big picture are obliged to become omniscient. And when they want to become omniscient, there's people like that, like the German sociologist Max Weber. He said to understand why the West went through an industrial revolution and the East didn't. What was it about? What were the characteristics of Western Europe that led to the Industrial Revolution? And so he did this investigation of Chinese civilizations, Indian civilizations, everything, to figure out what the cultural and economic and legal systems, what led to this. And because he had to know everything about all these cultures, he had to rely on the research of other people. And the research that he relied on turned out to be, in many cases, not very good. And so even though he was thorough and pretty smart, he just couldn't know everything. And for him to have a good thesis really required that. This is a problem. If you want to take any little thing and you want to understand it, it just turns out so much there, and so many people have already written on it, and so many of these people have already made mistakes, and you can't trust your own data. You have to get data from other people, and they make a mistake. It's actually very, very difficult. And the material world is so vast and so complicated that we discover that we only know just a little fragment of that. And we try to connect all the dots and put together a theory, and new dots keep showing up, and dots we think are secure keep getting erased. And so the whole thing becomes very, very difficult. Yet, somehow or other, we need some guidance or direction through this material world. Where are we supposed to go? How are we supposed to get it? That's why it's said that Prabhupada gives the example that whenever you get a piece of technology, you know, you get a new laptop or a piece of communications equipment, there's a manual that goes with it. My mother recently got a new car, a Mercedes. And she absolutely couldn't figure out what to do because the dial was so full of, the dashboard, and everywhere there are buttons for this, buttons for that. Everything was automated, and she could do this thing and that thing. And I had to spend hours with her going through the manual for this button, that button, what this one did, what that one did. And without that manual, she would be lost. That's just a, you know, a German car. But she required a manual to know what to do. So when the universe comes out, and here we are, we're here for some purpose, what are we supposed to do? We need the manual. And accordingly, because Krishna is very intelligent, he gives the manual. And that's the Vedas. And he creates the people who are supposed to be able to understand it. Those are the brahmanas. And convey it to others. The other thing is that the person, but just like when you get your new computer and you have a manual and you still can't figure it out, then you have tech support. So that you can access. Well, the super soul is sort of like tech support. If somehow or other you get access to the super soul, here is the composer of the manual, who knows how's everything and running, and who can guide and direct you. And so it becomes actually essential to know and to understand super soul in order to find our way into this world. Because not only do we have to know what the general principles of everything are, what the purpose of creation is, but the Lord has his mission, and we have to know how to apply these things in our own time, in our own place, in our own circumstances. We just need this stuff. That's what the super soul is for. And we have to have access to the super soul, or access to people who have access to the super soul, so we can actually understand what's going on. So, therefore, we have here this prayer for, ultimately becomes a prayer for enlightenment and for appreciation. So the first thing to do is to admit our own ignorance, our own inability, and then from there to go on to discover how we can get into position to know things. So this is the foundation of actually not only how spiritual knowledge, but also for material knowledge. We are enlightened whenever we know anything or come up with any arguments. We are inspired to do so by Super Soul. So when there are people who really want to know Krishna and to do what Krishna wants, then Krishna lets them know. If we don't want to know what Krishna wants, and in fact, if we really want ignorance, then Krishna gives us ignorance. That's what everything is saying. So it depends on what we want. We have to really want it. We can't just want it in a formal or official way because we feel we ought to, or we know it's the right thing to want, but not just yet. That won't work. We have to really desire it and desire it very ardently, and to give some evidence that we are sincere. In other words, Krishna has to be convinced that if he gives us intelligence and gives us knowledge, tells us what to do, we'll do it. Otherwise, why should he waste his time? I mean, he does waste his time anyways. It happens. But really, if we want the wholehearted guidance of Krishna, then we have to convince him that we'll take it. And more important, it's the companionship. It's the closest of Krishna. When one actually has direct knowledge of this close friend who's sitting very close to me and is wishing me well, then there's the end of all anxiety. One is in a secure position of knowing that the intelligence that guides me is not going to make a mistake and knows everything, and that this person is extremely friendly, extremely close, and is accessible to me at all times. So this is really worthwhile. And the question is how to get the active guidance of that person. Okay. Anyone would like any questions? I should say, by the way, that if something comes up during the course of this discussion, you can break in, and you don't have to wait to the end to ask questions. You can.
Would it?
Telephonically raise your hand at any point. Okay. Yeah.
I have a question for you.
Why don't you say your name so everybody this is like with the right?
This is Vaikuntha Goa Vrindavan Das today. Hello?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. From text number number 28, which we didn't go over today, but we sort of touched on it.
Text 28?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, is that? No. I have this old one set volume. 26 and 25. There's two. Are those different types of? Because both talk about knowing the Supreme Personality Godhead. Are they different types of knowing? Because one says he's on the next verse, which we haven't gone over, it says he's revealed, and then the one before it says he's not. He can't be understood.
Yeah. Right.
Are they? I guess what I'm trying to ask is, are they different types of one? Like in the text before in Pavan's clipboard, he says he's ananta, unlimited. He has all six opulences, and so he can't be understood because of that. Does that mean that once he's revealed in the sense of the next text, is that the same kind of revealing that would reveal all these different things? So then, like unlimited understanding of them, ananta.
Well, first of all, there's he's unknowable to some, and is knowable to others. And when he's knowable to others, he's knowable in different degrees. As far as being completely knowable, no.
I guess when in the next verse when he says he's revealed, in what sense does he mean that? Is that a sort of generic type of revelation, or is it like what you know once he's purified of the contamination, material existence, and all these other things.
Here it's just talking about. I think we'll have to go over it next time. But he's revealed on a certain platform. But the revelation of Krishna that comes to us. Is first of all gradual. When the revelation of Krishna takes place through chanting, and in the course of chanting, there's still more and more purification that takes place. So it says that first the name is revealed, the pure name, then Krishna's form. That's a revelation of Krishna. Then his guna, his qualities, and finally his lila, his pastimes. Which pastimes are revealed are the ones that are relevant to you. At least at first. So when the Lord's form is revealed. One has some inkling of his qualities, but then begins to discover these qualities more and more by direct experience. And then Krishna's pastimes. So it's a progressive. But of any getting to know Krishna, there's really no end to it. as however much you know, there's more to know. Sometimes, you know, in the material world, you can pretty much exhaust the possibilities of somebody. You seem to end up knowing pretty much everything, especially if it's a dog or something. A fairly simple human being. But when you're dealing with Krishna, who's ever new and who's always increasing, you can there's no end to it.
I guess the reason why I asked that question is because in the verse we just read,
yeah,
thinking like in the sort of like the, how you know that the because of the material, the matter, all these things can't understand all these things, and they can't understand their controller. I was thinking that the text was going to go on, since he's spiritual, he can understand all these things, and he can understand the controller. And just the fact that it didn't say that, he said he can't understand the controller.
Yeah, but at this point he can understand, because as long as he's still absorbed. As long as one is still absorbed materially, you still can't. You're still unable.
Is this specifically talking about only someone who's or is it, does it mean that no one can understand the Lord?
No, it means conditioned souls.
Oh.
Because the text 26 is going to start talking about how one can begin to come to understand the Supreme.
Yeah, that's why.
But certainly the biggest case for the non-existence of God is that no one can see him.
Uh-huh.
Right. I mentioned last week what Prabhupada said when we can't see God. And Prabhupada said, well, you can't see him, but that doesn't mean I can't see him. I'm not a rascal like you. Mm-hmm. And they say, can you show me God? Then they want to know, well, show me. Well, are you going to snap your fingers as God is going to show up? I mean, you can't even get the mayor of Philadelphia that way. You have to at least ask for an appointment and, you know, receive audience. So you have to have some kind of qualification. So this is entirely unreasonable. But that's the objection. What was that beep?
Oh. I was wondering when you're going to entertain other questions.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, this is Ramananda from Hawaii. Hare Krishna. This is a level of vacancy. Can we assume that every living being, or at least human beings, they feel consciousness beating them when something wrong, or they think about doing something wrong, they have this internal voice. So that must be the super soul. But sometimes you're so convinced about something, you're thinking that this has got to be right, and then later on we see that, oh my God, what a mistake I made.
Mm-hmm.
So how are conditioned souls like ourselves really, the super soul in my heart gives me a realization of what's, you know, just my mind.
You mean, so yeah, we do have a conscience, and that conscience seems to be the prompting of the super soul, but sometimes even so, what we get some strong intuition about something we should be doing, it turns out to be wrong. Right?
Yeah.
Are you asking how we can be sure?
Yeah.
How does that happen? Yeah. Well, it's you know, there's either clear reception or bad reception. And when the reception's bad, the words get garbled. There's a condition for actually getting clear direction from Super Soul. And that's called the condition of being in the mode of goodness, the sattva guna.
Mm.
Because the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance are distorting. It's like passing water through disturbed, passing light through disturbed water.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get a clear image of what's there. Let's say, okay, here's the example. When the water is completely still and transparent, then the light comes through undisturbed and the objects you see are fine. When the water is clear but turbulent, that's like the mode of passion.
Hmm.
You still see something, but you can't quite ascertain what it is. When it's turbulent and also the stirred up mud, then you practically can't see anything. except you no sound. So you don't get clear directions at all. So these are conditions like that for receiving the directions of super souls. One big problem is people try to give directions and claim it's some kind of transcendent knowledge, but are clearly not free from the modes of passion and the modes of ignorance. So that's what we need to look for in this matter. I mean, this is really a very important point because it ultimately leads to the fact that we need direction from people who are brahminical.
Mm-hmm.
We may not be brahminical, but if we're not, at least we should accept direction from people who are brahminical, and that's in principle. Sattva-guna is not a metaphysical thing. You know, the symptoms of sattva-guna are described. Sama, dhamma, tapa, socham, shantam, arjavam.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's recognizable. And that's who we should follow. Somebody who can just stand up on a platform and scream at the top of their lungs and rouse the crowds and excite their base, as they say. You know, that's what passes for guidance here. We're in big trouble, and we are in big trouble. Because there is no one in Sattva-guna. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. It's wonderful.
Okay. Anyone else want to come in with
Hare Krishna, Gurudev.
Yeah. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, Ratna Bhushan, Bhushan Prabhu here.
Hi.
Alex Muhammad Vaishnavas.
So you're in Sweden,
huh? Yes, very good.
Ramananda is in Hawaii. That's like a long span of many time zone. Go ahead.
Thank you. Do we still have some time to pose the question?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So, Gurudev, you were talking about how we're blinded by Krishna and he gives us the intelligence to forget him, how his will is a consequence of our desire. Sometimes we experience that we want to remember him, yet it doesn't happen to the degree and as quickly as we want it to take place.
Mm-hmm.
So in the end of your lecture, you were bringing up the point of eligibility. So my question is, how does the desire relate to the eligibility, or rather, how to increase the eligibility, and is that within the scope of our desire?
So there's our desire. Do I want Krishna or not? I think that desire relates to our eligibility.
Right.
The eligibility, I think, is shown by giving evidence of sincerity, because I think the experience is that we wouldn't be devotees or even aspiring devotees if there wasn't some desire to go back to Krishna, to return to Krishna. But it turns out that while that desire is there, at least in the beginning, it's mixed up with other desires.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually have contradictory desires. We simultaneously want Krishna, and we don't want Krishna.
Yeah.
Like the demigods, they're called Sakama devotees. They're servants of Krishna. They want to be pious. But at the same time, they have an enjoying mood, and sometimes they don't want him. So that's why Indra, you know, who is a very pious person, you know, in the whole episode with Vritrasura, he's acting like the demon. And Vritrasura, who's the demon, is like the devotee.
Mm.
And because Indra has mixed motives. So where do these mixed motives come from? Well, I would assume that, fundamentally we want Krishna because that's the swarup of the living entity. We want Krishna. But returning to Krishna seems to be a gradual process. And we discover that we go through some struggle and we think that, okay, surrender to Krishna, but here's some obstacle. And if we're engaged in surrendering to Krishna, usually we see what the obstacle is. And then we have to strive to show that we are interested in getting rid of it. And so Prabhupada says that Maya's job is to test us to see if we're really serious. So here I'm doing something for Krishna consciousness, and then Maya Devi says, in effect, is that what you really want? How about this? If she dangles one of the attractive things in front of us. And we have to say, oh, you mean I have to give this up too? Well, well, let me think about that. Or can I have both? Or some kind of deal making goes on, and then we have to come to the point where we make a decision. Then we think, okay, I've surrendered. But at least the discouraging thing is that it's usually not a one-step process. That there's more and more. Attachments are there, and some of them turn out to be pretty subtle. You can give up everything. In the early days of the movement, we all slept in one room, all the men, and we had a sleeping bag on the floor. And so we'd given up so many things. But there were one guy who his place on the floor was this corner, and if somebody else put a sleeping bag in his place, he was really upset. So there's a material desire for this little place, and that can be as big an impediment, as the desire to have 30,000 square feet mansion or something. Just your 12 square feet of floor or something like that. This is so one has to get over all these things, and so there's generally a progression of convincing Krishna. Not so much that we have to do it ourselves, but we really have to show Krishna what we really want. That's just my understanding of how it works.
So the increase of eligibility is a function of purifying the desires.
Yeah, purifying the desires, then we become eligible. And at first, it looks on the one hand, it looks hard, but if we're successful and give up some impediment, suddenly we advance in Krishna consciousness, and we say, "Wow, that's really wow! That was great. You know, I was attached to this stupid thing, and now I could have." Had this level of Krishna consciousness for so many years, and I didn't do it because of my petty attachment. But then, even with that, we just have this tendency to forget. I really wish it were easier, but that seems to be the usual state of things. We have to do it all over again on another level. And so it's showing that giving evidence of our sincerity. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Anyone else? One last one.
Good day.
Yeah.
It's Mahamuni. Please accept my humble obeisances.
My blessings, Mahamuni. What's on your mind?
So many things. Thank you very much for your class today.
You're welcome.
There's two questions in my mind. One's about self-evidence, and the other's about some sociological things about the movement, based on things you've said. But I guess I'll ask you the
self-evidence for another class, okay?
Save self-evidence for another class?
Yeah. We'll talk about self-evidence later on.
Okay, well, I guess...
That brings the ontological argument so many things.
Okay, all right. It's something like that, but it's based on things I've heard you say before. But, I guess then the question is, in your response to the previous question, it seems like the thrust of your response is that we're in a situation where we have the kind of urge for Krishna, but there are other urges and desires that we're not either fully aware of or we're somewhat aware of, and they push us in other directions, and we're kind of in a process of them coming to the surface, and then we have to try to cut them off or neglect them and let them starve. And as we go through this process, we become more and more dedicated to actually achieving Krishna.
Yeah, that's a pretty fair,
Okay. So my question is this. Both from personal experience and also just from having a lot of friends about the same age as I am in the movement, it seems like when we first come into Krishna consciousness, we go through a process of kind of undermining the kind of idols we had as like, these are things that we thought were good objectives for our lives. So it could be just personal advancement, or it could be like, whatever, saving this or that endangered species or whatever it is. We learn to cut them down and take up self-realization as really what we should be doing. And it seems like in the process of going through, you know, either big life changes or in other cases, maybe realizing that self-realization just isn't so easy or whatever, people find, without even choosing not to, people's intensity for self-realization lessens. Anyway, I'm getting to my question, I'm sorry. The point of it is that at the same time, because we don't really have any kind of other goals, whether they're motive goodness goals or motive passion goals, it seems like all that's left is a kind of weird life where we kind of want self-realization, but we also act kind of in a somewhat childish but maybe not too sinful way. Because if the intensity isn't directed towards self-realization, it's kind of directed towards sense gratification, but not the kind that'll make us feel that bad about ourselves. So anyway,
yeah, that's the description, right?
And so,
we slack off on our desire for self-realization, but because we really don't have anything else we're that interested in, we just play video games or something.
Right, or just kind of hover on the in the world where we're not really breaking the principles, or we sometimes are. But,
okay.
Whatever.
Trivial things, right?
Right, but that seems to me to be a not uncommon place to be.
I guess that's a fair description. That happens to people.
What would your advice be, particularly for those people who maybe their intensity is slackening because they really, on some level, feel like they're not self-realization, something they went for 10 years and it didn't work out the way they hoped or something like that? Because it seems to be more common, like I said, than I...
I guess it's a middle period. As you get older, you start to realize that there's no other project that's really going to work anyway. Ultimately, when everything is taken away, Krishna consciousness is the only thing you've got left. And it's a really good idea to think about that, because it happens faster than you think. You start to run out of time, especially time for your spiritual life. Unfortunately, wasted time, you can't be regained. I mean, it's really gone. And so it's really just a very, when people have become complacent in their spiritual life, they're really not interested in gross material enjoyment, but at the same time, they're not intense with their spiritual life. We're in that situation, and it's very, very difficult. You have to do something that's a change. One change is a trip to Vrindavan or Mayapur. that usually, it's a booster shot, sort of activates things again. And it's not necessarily, the reason those places are good is because there's just association of a lot of devotees. Mostly this kind of slacking off happens because we are with people who are not enthusiastic, and we need the association of enthusiastic people. So my enthusiasm gets weak, as it does sometimes. I just have to find somebody who will kind of reignite my interest in things. And then if I'm not interested in reigniting my interest, what are you supposed to do, right? Well, the thing is, it takes an alarm system or somebody, you know, that kind of shakes you up and says, don't forget what you're supposed to be doing. And that's all I can say. You know, give me a call or something. I don't know. I guess I'm the fire department that people should call if they.
Well, you've made it a lot easier by allowing me to call you once a week.
Yeah, anything else I can do, let me know. You know, with my limited power, I'll try to do it. Okay.
Thanks, Rudy.
Okay, I think we better call it quits. We're a little bit over time now. So thank you very much. It's a real pleasure being able to do this. It also keeps me enlivened in this way. And see you, hear you, something same time next week. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
Hare.
Srila Gurudev ki jai.